The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, Chris, my husband and I really enjoy your show. Thanks for doing what you do.
Hi, Chris, I love the show.
You're just breaking rules all over the place.
Thank you very, very much for your sane reasoning and conversation.
In that realm, the statement you issued, or that was issued earlier today, didn't include any explicit calls for China to stop detaining and harming protesters and journalists. Why not?
We're watching this closely, as you might expect we would. And again, we continue to stand up and support the right of peaceful protest. And I think we're going to watch this closely, and we'll see where things go.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
It's great to be with you today. Thursday, week just flying by here. So glad that you could be here again for us this morning. You 6 o'clock people, don't tell anybody else. Those of you who've been with the show for a while, you know this. Those of you who are new to the show, you should know, as I like to say, as we begin every show from time to time, it is you here right now. And don't, I'm not going to say this after seven. I only say this every now and again quietly here in the 6 o'clock. You people here in the 6 o'clock hour are my favorite. You can't tell the others. 610-850-0990 is the number. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. You know how gaslighting is the word of the year from the Merriam-Webster's Dictionary? May I give you a demonstration of what it is? The reason it's the word of the year is because we see it on display every single day. Democrats every day engage in it. Gaslighting. It may be worth digging up the definition again, just to refresh the textbook definition of what it is. But here is, in real time, what gaslighting is. When Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren, they catch up with her in the halls of Congress and get her take on Elon Musk. Now, if this is not gaslighting on full display, I don't know what is. Take a listen.
Republicans say that Democrats are picking on Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is doing just fine.
But do you think that users have a right to freedom of speech, even if what they're saying is wrong or offensive?
I think that one human being should not decide how millions of people communicate with each other. One human being should not be able to go into a dark room by himself and decide, oh, that person gets heard from, that person doesn't. That's not how it should work.
Psychological manipulation of a person, usually over an extended period of time, that causes the victim to question the validity of their own thoughts, perception of reality, or memories, and typically leads to confusion, loss of confidence and self-esteem, uncertainty of one's emotional or mental stability, dependency on the perpetrator. Dependency on the perpetrator is probably the most key point in the definition of gaslighting. It leads to dependency on the person who's doing the lying. And that's exactly what Elizabeth Warren is doing there. Now, these, you know, I was just reading a story this morning that Democrats want to hurry and get some antitrust stuff done before the lame duck session of Congress ends and Republicans take control of the House. Right, the hell they do. They want to hurry and lock it up, that, you know, make it look like they've done something to big tech, when in fact they actually have lobbyists for big tech inside the Biden administration. This from The Hill: White House pressured to recuse legislative director from antitrust talks. Advocacy groups urging the White House to recuse the director of the Office of Legislative Affairs from interacting with Congress about antitrust bills targeting tech giants, pointing to her past work as a public policy director at Facebook. This woman is called Louisa Terrell. Six groups have said that despite there being no legal requirement to recuse this woman, they say that the White House should adopt a higher standard in the matter and insist on recusal. The letter sent this week to White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain. This woman, Terrell, her past at Facebook, in addition to her past there, the letter cites Terrell rarely mentions antitrust legislation and pivots conversations to other tech issues like data privacy. The White House telling Bloomberg that Terrell has been supportive of the legislative effort and rejects claims she was disengaged. The letter has been signed by the American Economic Liberties Project, something called Others 98, blah, 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 a bunch of groups you've never heard of. The future of competition in digital markets, as well as the White House's credibility on big tech-related issues, is on the line, the groups write. See, here's the dirty little secret, back to gaslighting and Elizabeth Warren. They're perfectly happy with big tech censorship. They're perfectly happy with the control big tech exerts in the national discussion because their party runs it. They have no interest in supporting antitrust reform. Advocacy groups supporting reform have been urging lawmakers to take action to pass two key bills targeting big tech giants during the lame duck session before Republicans take control. Because as if Republicans aren't interested. Well, I'm sure there are some who aren't. Two main bills proponents are pushing are the something called the American Innovation and Choice Online Act and the Open App Markets Act. Bills that have advanced in both chambers but have not been called to floor votes. The first bill aims to prevent companies from preferencing their own products and services. The second bill aims at regulations to peel back certain dominance in app stores. So it's toothless, basically. And, of course, big tech, tech giants and industry groups here from the Hill have pushed back, arguing the proposals could pose security concerns and undermine content moderation efforts. Undermine content moderation efforts. That's an argument from big tech? That's an interesting thing to say. Hey, you can't regulate us. You might stifle our moderation of content efforts. No. That's just the point. That's why you people should be regulated. You weren't given immunity from persecution, prosecution, to moderate content. You've been given legal protections by Congress and the American taxpayer because you agreed not to be moderators. You were supposed to be community billboards, and instead you've been acting like fascists. And Elon Musk has shown us what you've been up to. He bought Twitter. He fired everyone in the place, and now he's starting to release how they've been doing business. And what we know and what he's confirmed is, yes, they have been actively involved in silencing conservatives, silencing people on COVID, silencing people on vaccine information that's counter to get the shot and shut up about it, among other things. There was rumor for a while that Apple was threatening to take Twitter off their app store, which would effectively kill Twitter. Now, Elon went to meet with Tim Cook at Apple yesterday and said, it's fine. Twitter CEO Elon Musk Wednesday acknowledged in his takeover the obvious reality Twitter has interfered in elections. Musk's explosive assertion came in response to comments made by Twitter's former head of trust and safety, indicated the social media platform was not safer under the Tesla CEO leadership. Roth was speaking at a Knight Foundation conference on Tuesday. He explained why he resigned from Twitter, accusing Musk of running the company like a dictator. One of my limits was if Twitter started being ruled by dictatorial edict rather than by policy, there's no longer a need for my role for doing what I do. They were operating as a dictatorship now. That's the point. Again, back to gaslighting. Psychological manipulation of a person, usually over an extended period of time, that causes the victim to question the validity of their own thoughts, perception of reality, or memories, that typically leads to confusion, loss of confidence and self-esteem, uncertainty of one's emotional or mental stability, and dependency on the perpetrator. Dependency on the perpetrator. So this guy, who was the former head of trust and safety, is running around gaslighting. He wasn't the dictator, you see. Elon Musk is the dictator, because Elon Musk is opening the vault of secrets at Twitter and telling us all what they did, and he's putting free speech back on a platform that used to be supposedly a community billboard for free speech, because he's returning your voice to the platform. He's the dictator. Listen to Elizabeth Warren again. He's the dictator.
Republicans say that Democrats are picking on Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is doing just fine.
But do you think that users have a right to freedom of speech, even if what they're saying is wrong or offensive?
I think that one human being should not decide how millions of people communicate with each other. One human being should not be able to go into a dark room by himself and decide, oh, that person gets heard from, that person doesn't. That's not how it should work.
That's literally what they're doing. That's literally what they've been. Folks, this is what gaslighting is. Causes victim to question the validity of their own thoughts, perception of reality, loss of confidence and self-esteem. She says this with such calm certainty, and you hear it and it makes you want to come out of your skin, because you and I know what they've been doing. If you're anyone who has tried to post anything related to COVID that's counter to shut up and get the shot, you know exactly. You've experienced it. You see it every day. You see to this day, you see it on Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram. Anytime you post anything about COVID, it's tagged. Careful, careful. You might be dealing with someone reckless, peddling misinformation. Click here for the truth, says Meta. Every time you post anything about anything related to COVID, to this day, you know it. We're living it. We see it every day. Many of you in this audience have either been kicked off or shadow banned social media. And Pocahontas says, one human being should not be able to go into a dark room and decide, oh, this person gets to be heard from, this person doesn't. That's not how it should work. Agreed, but that's how it's been working. And Elon Musk is exposing that. Over at CNN, yesterday, heads began to roll. Much like at Twitter, thousands and thousands of people lost their job. Next up, CNN. Thousands and thousands of CNN employees are about to lose their job. Jeff Zucker destroyed CNN, just like the dictators at Twitter destroyed Twitter. CNN is as decimated as Twitter. Disney, I wouldn't call them as decimated as CNN and Twitter, but pretty damn close. They've had a change. Twitter was saved by Elon Musk. And the first thing Elon Musk did was gut Twitter to rebuild it as a fair and balanced place. And that is what should happen at CNN. It won't happen, of course, but can CNN recover from being totally committed to the wokeness? I don't know. Like this Chris Licht guy who runs CNN now says he wants to hear from all voices. He's supposedly trying to Elon Musk up Twitter. Don Lemon went on the Colbert Report, or the Colbert Show, whatever they call it now, Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and actually said, we were never liberal. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, our boss, Chris Licht, the new guy, oh yeah, all he wants us to do is play it straight, which is what we've always done. Gaslighting. Psychological manipulation of a person, usually over an extended period of time, that causes the victim to question the validity of their own thoughts. Don Lemon goes on a television show and says, we've always been fair and straight down the middle. We're not committed leftists. Now, I personally have been on Don Lemon's show. I have personally been asked in the middle of a presidential campaign when the Democrat running for office, the news breaks the night I'm on with TV with Don Lemon. The news breaks that she is at a private event and says half the country that votes for Donald Trump you could put into a basket of deplorables. That news broke the night I'm on. And I say, Don, shouldn't we be talking about the fact that Hillary Clinton just called half the country's voters deplorable? I'm not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about Donald Trump's taxes and whether or not you're concerned about Donald Trump's tax returns. I fought with him about it. I was never invited back again. We've never been liberal. We've never been left-leaning, says Don Lemon to Stephen Colbert this week. Even Colbert doesn't believe it. Gaslighting. Elon Musk is the blueprint. Now, Bob Iger, I know a lot of you. By the way, I got lots of notes from you yesterday. Stigall, I don't agree. I heard that clip from Iger, and I don't know what you're talking about, that he's surrendering or that he gives in. Iger's a left-winger. Yeah, I know. You're missing the point, folks. That's not. I wasn't suggesting that Bob Iger had some big conservative enema or something. That's not. That. I'm sorry I left you with the impression that Bob Iger at Disney was a conservative now. That wasn't my point. The admission in the Bob Iger clip was not that he's now a conservative and sees the error in the political woke ways of the old Disney CEO. That wasn't the point. The point was, he said, I want to get back to the business of Disney being in the business of family entertainment. I'm not interested in getting in political fights. He basically said, yes, I agree with everything they've been doing. I'm just not going to publicly fight about it the way the other guy did. I think it's bad for our business to get in public political fights. That's the win. Not that Bob Iger is somehow now going to vote for Ron DeSantis for president. I didn't mean that. That was not what I was trying to drive at yesterday. The point is, are you willing to appeal to everyone broadly? Are you willing to open up your theme parks? Are you willing to make family-friendly movies? Are you willing to create news product that is fair and even-handed? Are you going to follow the Elon Musk blueprint? You know, Tim Cook meets with Elon Musk yesterday at Apple, and he says, we're not going to take you down off the App Store. Okay. Tim Cook would do well then now to reverse course in China and let those poor people use his AirDrop function so they can communicate with one another without using the internet or without using cell phone service to do so. Tim Cook's devices allow the Chinese people to communicate with one another without using communist China-controlled cell towers and internet services. And rather than shut that off, Tim Cook should open that up. You see, freedom, fairness, openness, that's the Elon Musk blueprint right now. And again, I don't know Elon Musk. I don't want to get out over my skis and tell you, much like the Bob Iger thing. I'm not telling you that these guys are now Ronald Reagan reincarnate or something. That's not the point. The point is, at this moment, they seem to be reversing course. Apple, Twitter, CNN, Facebook, Disney. Massive issues confronting media and tech companies right now. Censorship, China. These are all related issues. Media, big tech, the Democrat Party, they're all in bed with China. And they admire authoritarianism. They love goon squads. They love top-down government control. That's why what Elizabeth Warren says is such gaslighting. She loves the idea of one human being able to go into a dark room and deny certain people having a voice. That's not how it should work, she says. That's how it's working. Tim Cook at Apple is literally allowing Xi Jinping, the communist chairman of China, to silence people who oppose what he's doing with zero COVID lockdowns. And she has nothing to say about it. She thinks Elon Musk is the bad guy. Gaslighting. If Musk reveals Twitter has an unholy alliance with Democrats in government. And he shows us a blueprint as to how they crushed the flow of information to impact elections. Perhaps there's going to be some progress made here. That's what Musk says he's about to do. You know, key to some of this information about the election is going to be the Hunter Biden laptop story. What was the interaction between Twitter and the government? We already know the FBI's interaction with Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg just decided to blurt it out on Joe Rogan's podcast. So let's hope Elon continues to release this information before he's persuaded to keep it hidden. Gaslighting. 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 Everywhere you look, it's gaslighting. Twitter was a safe, acceptable, fine place to communicate until Elon Musk took it over. And now you see, it may be dangerous. And we're monitoring the situation. Because Elon Musk owns it. Rather, what is that an admission of, ultimately? Democrats are gaslighting and telling you now that Twitter is dangerous. So what's it telling you? What are they actually saying, if you comb through the gaslighting? They were happy with Twitter when what? When they were in control of it. And now because there's someone that is not actively working to silence conservatives on it. Again, Elon Musk is not some kind of, you know, he's not the Freedom Caucus. He's not Jim Jordan, all right? Elon Musk is a billionaire. He's an entrepreneur. And he himself has said he's been a committed Democrat voter since he's been participating in politics. Only publicly for the first time has he said, I'd vote for Ron DeSantis. When the question was posed to him how he would vote or who he would vote for in the future, he said, I have no choice but to vote for Republicans because I see what the Democrat Party has become. And with that, Democrats now are trying to convince the country and all Twitter users that he's the dangerous force and that everyone on Twitter is now dangerous. Whereas just 6 months ago, Twitter was the place to be. I mean, Jim Carrey posted this bizarre. Again, here's what's funny is I know most of you aren't even Twitter users. You know, I have used it heavily for, I don't know, 12, 13 years now. I'm a pretty heavy Twitter user and consumer. But I recognize that I'm still a small minority of the country. Most of you don't use it. Media people and political people use it. And because we spend a lot of time covering and talking about media people and political people, we all sort of feed off of one another, and our conversations largely circle around what we are saying and putting out there on Twitter. And when Donald Trump was using it so effectively, that's when Twitter really went into another stratosphere. But they're telling you, we ran it and it was good. Now we don't control it purely and it's bad. It's dangerous. This came up with Pepe Le Pew yesterday at the White House. Peter Doocy got into a back and forth with Pepe Le Pew about, so you guys think Elon Musk is dangerous, right? When are you guys, so you're just going to quit using Twitter, I assume. Delete the account, yeah?
When are you guys going to delete the White House Twitter account?
Why would we do that?
Well, you're saying that you're keeping an eye on Twitter because it might not be a suitable platform, so why use it?
Look, I want to be very clear here. The president has always said, and he has been very, very clear in his belief that it is important of social media platforms to continue to take steps to reduce hate speech and misinformation. And will continue to say that. But media platforms make independent choices about their information that they present. And so, look, I don't have anything to share on any policy or any changes that we will be making. We have multiple platforms, as you know, that we utilize to communicate with the American people.
Right. you know, social media companies have their independent ability to decide what gets out there and what doesn't. But we will continue to monitor their speech to make sure we don't deem it hate. So while they're totally autonomous and we have nothing to do with what they put out there, we will also consistently call out what we deem hate. Oh, I see. From the largest bully pulpit in the world. So out of both sides of her mouth, Pepe Le Pew says, yeah, they're free to do whatever they want to do as a company. But we're going to continue to monitor the hate they publish or allow to be published. So Ducey presses her on this. What do you mean you're going to be monitoring some kind of speech?
When you say that you're going to be monitoring some of the speech on there, if you see something that you don't like, would you try to shut Twitter down?
So look, you know, when you talk about monitoring, you know, it is, I hate to break it to you, Peter, just like everybody else, we very much monitor the news. We pay close attention to everything that you all are reporting, and Twitter's in the news a lot. And so that's what we're paying attention to. We're paying attention to what is in the news and what is being reported on the misinformation that's out there. Let's not forget there's groups like NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, and the public health leaders have been very vocal about their concerns as well. So yes, we are reading what you all are writing and looking at what you all are reporting about the misinformation that is out there. But, you know, I would hope that all Americans, including social media companies, civil rights organizations I just laid out, including Fox as well, will agree that we need to call out hate speech and misinformation.
Right. We're paying attention. We're monitoring you closely. You're on notice. We're watching all of you all the time for your hate speech and your misinformation. Now, folks, again, Twitter, as well as Facebook, and I believe Instagram and other social media like it, they have special dispensation from the federal government to operate as basically, my word, not the legal word, community billboards. That's all these are. These are not news sources. Twitter, you see what they've done? This is the news speak. This is gaslighting. Your free speech on Twitter, your posting on Facebook and Instagram, when you do these things, this is now to Karine Jean-Pierre and to the people that run social media on the left, this is news. So when I put my opinion on Facebook or Twitter, they're now calling it misinformation, hate speech, news that can't be trusted. That's gaslighting. In a sane world, you'd say, well, no, that's Chris Stigall, a talk radio host, putting his opinion up on a community billboard that's digital. That's what it was supposed to be. Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, these are supposed to be places where we just pin our thoughts or pin our pictures or here's what I think about this or can you believe that or my sources tell me this. It's not a news source. It's not CNN. It's not Fox. It's not NBC. It's not the New York Times. Those are, say it with me, class, those are publishers. Publishers of news have a responsibility under the law that Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and these other digital companies, they're not responsible to you and me the way designated news organizations are. As distinguished by law, this is important everybody understands this. Section 230, it's called. It protects digital platforms like Twitter and Facebook and others from being sued. If somebody says something, in theory, if somebody says something about me or, my family or whatever on Twitter, there's really very little recourse I have. It's a high bar to clear anyway, slander, defamation, stuff like that. But these are... said another way, the people running Twitter can't be sued by me if somebody gets on Twitter. You know, Fast Eddie gets on Twitter and starts calling me names or accusing me of this or that. I can't sue Twitter for allowing him to do that because of Section 230, a federal law that basically says, you know what, you can go after Eddie if you want, but you can't come after me who owns Twitter because I'm just I think I've kind of called it like the park billboard. Like, you can't sue the city of a public, you know, that owns a public billboard because somebody goes into the public park and pins, I don't know, something hateful about you on the community billboard. Like, you can't sue the city for that. That's the community's billboard. You can try to find the individual that pinned it up on the community billboard and go after them, but the city's not responsible. Similarly, Twitter and Facebook isn't. They were never meant to be monitors. They were never meant to be publishers. News organizations are publishers. So, I don't know. For instance, when NBC, this guy's been gone now, missing from action for like 2 weeks. The guy that reported on NBC that Paul Pelosi was not under any kind of emergency or duress at all. When cops showed up at the house, he opens the door for the cops and then walks back into the guy who then beat him with a... What did he beat him up with?
A hammer.
The hammer, that's right. Weird story. Still weird. The only guy that actually told a different version of the official story that we're told about that was an NBC News reporter, and it aired on NBC News on the Today Show. And they took it down and said it didn't meet journalistic standards, right? And they suspended him. Now, this is NBC News supposedly policing itself and holding itself to a journalistic standard. And, you know, in theory, if in fact that really is an untrue story, they could be sued by the Pelosi family or whatever because they're journalists. You can't do that to Twitter. You can't do that to Facebook. But, as we know, Twitter and Facebook, Meta now, they have been acting just like NBC acted with that reporter. But they've been doing it to just average Joes like me and you. Just people who want to post our thoughts. Hey, I don't like that Joe Biden. And just delete you. Just shadow ban you. Just throw you off. Just tag your post as misinformation. Keep people from seeing it. What Pepe Le Pew just did there was really rather artful. We monitor all the news. In other words, what she did was say, does everybody follow this? This is really kind of important. You posting your opinion on Facebook is the same as Peter Doocy's reporting on Fox News. Do you catch that she did that? They're conflating a digital billboard in Twitter and Facebook with news organizations. And if the right people don't run them, or the wrong people are given voice on these digital billboards, they should be shut down and prohibited from operation, just the same as if a trained journalist went on a network television news broadcast and broadcast misinformation. Be very clear about this and be very on guard about what we're watching. This is exactly what I warned you about last week with the Colorado Springs shooting. Can you go back and find that FBI agent last week on MSNBC? Do you remember him? The twerpy little SOB that went on MSNBC and said Tucker Carlson and other shows like his should be prosecuted. We didn't know anything about the guy who ends up calling himself non-binary. Turns out he's supposedly one of them, the LGBTQ community. Shoots up this gay nightclub. Before we knew any of the facts, we knew he was a ticking time bomb. He has a history of run-ins with the law. Colorado red flag laws probably should have prevented him from buying a gun. But nonetheless, his official legal defense is he's non-binary. Okay, so he's certainly not a Tucker Carlson viewer. He's certainly no conservative. But they were trying to suggest, before we knew anything about that shooting, it had to be speech. It had to be shows like Tucker's that were encouraging people like that to go in and target and shoot up gay clubs. Because shows like Tucker's or shows like mine stand against the radical gendered reassignment butchery the children's hospitals are doing. Because we talk about things like that, we're probably causing guys to go in and shoot up nightclubs. And as such, we should be prosecuted. Remember when he said this? Listen.
prosecutors and police, they found quickly what they needed. That means they know this was a bias crime. This is likely, and since we've heard reports that the subject isn't cooperating with police, that means they likely found clear and convincing evidence on his devices. If he's a consumer of the people we just rattled off, from Lauren Boebert to Tucker Carlson, let's get it out. Let's get it out at trial. Let's expose it for what it is, name it and shame it. He's a consumer of these people, and those people should face civil consequences from the victims. The other thing they want to deny is...
That's enough. Lauren Boebert, the congresswoman from Colorado, and Tucker Carlson should be sued for their speech by the victims of a shooting. Because it's obvious to Mr. Former FBI guy, whoever the hell that little twerp is, it's obvious to him. It's very clear. It's just crystal clear. It's just absolutely true that this guy shot up a gay nightclub because he listens to Lauren Boebert and watches Tucker Carlson. So we got to start suing them. Of course, none of that wound up being true at all, did it? But that's what he went on television and said, and MSNBC didn't challenge that, not even a little bit. So again, listen carefully when Peter Doocy presses Karine Jean-Pierre about Twitter.
When you say that you're going to be monitoring some of the speech on there, if you see something that you don't like, would you try to shut Twitter down?
So look, you know, when you talk about monitoring, you know, it is, I hate to break it to you, Peter, just like everybody else, we very much monitor the news. We pay close attention to everything that you all are reporting, and Twitter's in the news a lot. And so that's what we're paying attention to. We're paying attention to what is in the news and what is being
Twitter's
reported
in the news.
On the news. Misinformation that's out there. Let's not forget there's groups like NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, and the public health leaders have been very vocal about their concerns as well. So, yes, we are reading what you all are writing and looking at what you all are reporting about the misinformation that is out there. But, you know, I would hope that all Americans, including social media companies, civil rights organizations I just laid out, including Fox as well, will agree that we need to call out hate speech and misinformation.
This is dangerous. We're watching you, says the White House spokesmouth. And we think that all of you ought to watch one another. That means you ought to watch Twitter. And you have a responsibility. We all have a responsibility to watch one another and call out speech. And remember, the question was, you're monitoring, and when you see something you don't like, you're going to try to shut Twitter down. Do you notice she didn't? The answer should be, we have no authority to shut Twitter down. That should be the immediate answer to that question. No, we're not going to try to shut Twitter down. We can't do that. They're a private company. We're the White House. We have no authority to shut any company down. Of course not. That's not what she said. A former FBI official on TV saying Lauren Boebert and Tucker Carlson should be criminally charged for the shooting at a nightclub. Before we knew any facts. Speech. And you know how it starts? It starts by, and I know this ticks some of you off, when you take even a guy that I have no time for, Alex Jones, and you, in a court of law, you basically force him to pay every nickel he's ever earned for his speech to families of Sandy Hook over his speech. And I look, you know, people have said that there, you know, that there were damages that people, if he was inciting harm or violence or causing people to go to these families' homes and harass them or something, that's a different matter. But if that is purely about a guy went on the internet and said something crazy, and now he should have to pay tons of money because people's feelings were hurt, even as vile as they may have been, this is how we get there. You take extreme examples like his, and you slowly work backwards. Somebody shoots up a gay nightclub. Well, you know, Tucker Carlson talks a lot about genital mutilation of kids on cable news. That probably inspires some of these nuts to start shooting up gay nightclubs. We should do something about Tucker Carlson. You see how we get there pretty quickly? I do. Sorry, folks, I'm in the free speech business. I'm a little prickly about this. Sorry if it seems as though I'm beating a dead horse, but I think it matters.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Thank you, Chris, very much. You have a great show. You have a highly rated show, too, by the way, in case they haven't been telling you lately.
Good morning, Chris. You're my voice of hope.
And we're addressing the climate crisis as well. The climate plan we just passed is going to reduce emissions by 1 billion metric tons by 2030. And because of our policies, gas prices are coming down.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Glad to be with you today. I tell you something, if you've not become a Harump Society member yet, you are missing out. And tomorrow, I will just tell you this, tomorrow's the day. For everyone who becomes a member, we launch the Harump Society store. And for all subscribing members, you're going to enjoy a nice discount at the Harump Society store, which launches in earnest tomorrow, just in time for Christmas. So if you have not subscribed, I think you're going to love the content. I am personally thrilled with the way if you're a Substack user, you already know how Substack works and how to use it. If you've never used it and you go, I don't want to learn something new, I get it. Believe me. We waited a long time on launching the show newsletter, the Harump Society, because I was investigating different platforms. People said, go try this one, go try that one. And every time I would get on one, if I couldn't understand it, I wasn't about to use it and try to explain it to you. I needed to be able to use something where I could publish the newsletter and be able to come on the air and communicate it to you. And I'm telling you that Substack is the most user-friendly format there is. Like, it's ridiculous easy. It's not hard to read. It's not hard to use. The app is really user-friendly. I think the presentation of the newsletter looks great digitally. Wouldn't you say, Fast Eddie? It's just a user-friendly, streamlined look, I think.
Yeah, no, when you had asked me in the beta testing mode, you're just like, all right, like, you gotta, would you sit down and when you receive this, would you look at it? How far down would you go? Like, would you stay with it? And I'm like, absolutely. I'm looking, I'm reading. There's a nice chunk of content from you as far as words go. Then we have some video quotes. It's very nice looking and it's easy to guide.
Yeah, so thank you for saying so. I'm awfully proud of it, and I think it's great content. It's, it's stuff that I write. I used to spend time writing on Facebook. Sometimes I'd submit it to Town Hall, and just to be perfectly honest with you, I got so tired of trolls. I said, why am I sitting down and writing this stuff and just spitting it out in the ether to people who hate my guts? I would rather write this stuff for people that are my friends, and you're my friends. And so I decided to create a clubhouse called the Harump Society where I could write my thoughts and you could respond with one another and interact. Also, I put, kind of retrospective stories up from the past, a look back in history that I think can help us learn or go, hey, remember when this thing happened? We're watching it happen again. Go back in the archives and look at old news stories. I put up a little scripture verse usually. And this particular month, yesterday and through the month of December, I'm doing an Advent special with the show Spiritual Advisor, which I think you're going to enjoy. I got a half-hour presentation where I talk with a great friend of mine and pastor as he guides us through the Advent season. And we start with week number one yesterday. So check it out. I think you're going to love it. And like I said, if you're a subscriber, you'll get a discount on the Harump Society store, which launches tomorrow for December. Fastest way to get there, if you don't know Substack, go to chrisstegall.com and the Harump Society link is right there. Or if you know Substack, look up the Harump Society. That's H-A-R-R-U-M-P-H. Our great friend Patrick Hedger is back, executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. They are squarely zeroed in. I just I saw a couple of friends of mine who are now incoming freshmen to the House Republican caucus. They were having their big party last night down at the Wharf in D.C. It's a beautiful little setting. Looks like they were having a nice night. Guys like Patrick Hedger, I bet, would love to be in a room with all these incoming freshman Republicans to get their minds right on things like earmarks and pork barrel spending. Right, Patrick? Good morning.
Hey, good morning. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, that's an intoxicating scene for these guys. I've got a very good friend who's a new freshman member, and he texts with me. And, you know, I kind of tease, but I'm kind of serious. As you know, don't get intoxicated, man. Remember why you're running. Remember why you went. How many of these guys remember why they ran and went, do you think, Patrick?
Well, based on the vote that they had yesterday in the House Republican Conference, they're voting on the rules for how they're going to run the House. Only about 50 or so remember why they were sent, because the conference voted 2-1 to retain the practice of earmarks and pork barrel spending under Republican control for the 118th Congress. So pretty disappointing. I'm glad there's at least 50 that understand that earmarks are a breeding ground for corruption and gross federal overspending, but we've got a lot of work to do.
Here's the thing, as you know, everybody hates Congress but loves their congressman, and earmarks are what make members of Congress feel great when they go home to their respective districts and say, hey, look what I got tucked under the highway bill, you know, $1 million for this new bridge, and I'll be there for the ribbon cutting, and everybody in the community will slap them on the back and say, hey, our congressman brought the money home. So that's why that's very intoxicating, just so everybody understands.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's the most tangible thing a member of Congress can do to be visible and making a difference in the community. Unfortunately, it really adds up, right? A lot of folks will defend pork barrel earmark spending, say, hey, it's a little grease for the skids to get things moving through Congress and to allow Congress to do their job. You know, and really a lot of these projects are just a drop in the bucket. Well, if you leave a bucket out in the rain, eventually it's going to be full. And right now we're staring down a $31 trillion national debt. Our debt service costs, because interest rates have adjusted to their historical norms, are now rivaling that of what we spend on our military. And that is completely unsustainable going forward. And so to retain the practice of greasing the skids, spending money to spend more money in this Congress, feels like the height of irresponsibility, especially considering the inflation that we're dealing with.
Macron, the French president, is here. He's come stateside to meet with Biden, and apparently he's already popping off about the Deficit Reduction Act. I mean, when you got a guy from Western Europe mocking our bloated spending practices to supposedly reduce the deficit, when even a Frenchman understands that our gross, wasteful spending has created inflation and made matters worse, you know it's bad.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you know, Europe is a continent that's been essentially, its economic growth has been paralyzed by governments that are just too big and too much of a part of their GDP. So for them to come over and understand that the Inflation Reduction Act is anything but the Inflation Reduction Act, that's really telling. I mean, talk about a canary in the coal mine.
Are you at all optimistic? I mean, I guess given what you just said about earmarks, the answer is no. But I mean, what do you think, if anything, this Congress, this House, these new Republicans with a slim but still a majority, can they do anything? They do have the power of the purse. Are they going to use it to restrain it?
Yeah, I'm not super optimistic about restraining federal spending. I think we're in for several more years of continuing resolutions and omnibus spending bills and Congress not actually doing their job. And you know, when nobody gets what they want, everybody gets what they want. So, which is just lots and lots of federal spending. So I'm not super optimistic about that. What I am really optimistic about is the fact that Congress ultimately has no oversight authority over executive branch agencies. And I'm optimistic about IRS oversight, SEC oversight. We've got a lot of these three-letter agencies out there that are doing things that they absolutely should not be doing. And congressional Republicans now have the gavels to be able to bring these officials in and say, hey, why is the SEC trying to regulate emissions? Isn't that the EPA's job? And by the way, why did the SEC just miss the biggest fraud in human history? So things like that I'm optimistic for.
Energy, I have noted that prices at the pump have fallen pretty dramatically from, you know, when they were much, much higher just months ago. But as our chief economist, Steve Moore, and I have discussed, that isn't because we're making more. That isn't because there's a glut of supply in the market. That's because consumption is down, way down, and that can only mean bad things economically in the new year. I mean, when you that's the tip of the iceberg. When you start to see people not consuming oil, that means people are driving less. Consumption is down, and when consumption is down, economic activity is down, and that, you know, and so it snowballs. That's the way I read it. We're not producing more oil. Everybody understands that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much so a leading indicator of where the economy is heading. And I think the tech sector for a long time has also been a leading indicator, right? The tech sector saw COVID before anybody else. Everybody thought they were paranoid. They saw it coming. And turns out they were right about how severe the situation would get. And now the tech sector is the leading indicator with layoffs. You're starting to see most of the major layoffs are hitting in the tech sector. And I think that, unfortunately, that may begin to spread throughout the rest of the economy. And even the Biden administration admits it. This whole student loan pause thing doesn't jive with a good job market. If the job market's so great as they're saying, why pause? Why continue to pause student loan repayment? I don't think they should do it anyway. But that is an indicator that I think the White House sees some rough waves on the horizon.
Are you, without the Senate, without control of the Senate, without a president that's going to sign anything, what tangible thing can House Republicans do in your mind? What is there a physical act they can take without Senate help, without the president's help, economically speaking, in your view?
You know, it's mostly about stopping the bad at this point. And you know, that tends to have a tangible impact. I mean, a divided government is a government that, you know, it tends to create some stability. So
stop the bleeding, sort of, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then, you know, continue to push forward pieces of legislation that can form a coherent agenda or begin to test with the American people what they want, what they want to see. And then something like that I saw in this last election is that Republicans weren't presenting much of an alternative to Democrats. You have a lot of Republicans that are out there running, abandoning free markets and essentially just, you know, being Democrats, but kind of mean. And I don't think that's a winning agenda. And you've seen with the reinstatement of earmarks that, again, Republicans aren't offering much of an alternative. So I think a really great opportunity for this Congress would be to present tangible pieces of legislation, test them out, hammer out the details of them, and get them ready to pass in hopefully a more favorable Congress after a pretty friendly Senate map for Republicans coming up.
Patrick Hedger is the executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Notice through all this, you never hear Democrats, you never hear Biden. He'll talk about wiping your student loan debt away, but never do they talk about reducing your tax burden, do they?
Yeah, funny enough. Isn't that funny? In fact, they do the opposite. They brag about the new IRS agents that they're going to hire. 80,000 new IRS agents tucked into the Inflation Reduction Act. And look, the IRS data is painfully clear. The most audited county in the country is a poor, rural, mostly minority county in Mississippi. The IRS doesn't go after the people that have the accountants and the lawyers to be able to fight back. They go after the little guy. And so I'm pretty scared for Americans going forward with so much more IRS capacity in place and no real structural reforms to that agency to ensure taxpayer privacy and accountability and ensure that agency isn't being politicized.
ProtectingTaxpayers.org. Patrick Hedger, thanks for your time today, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
610-850-0990, the number, 610-850-0990. Coming up, we saw something really interesting in the Wall Street Journal. There's a little microbrewery that has popped up in South Jersey. And as it turns out, I didn't know this. I had no idea. But New Jersey has, and I guess it shouldn't surprise me, there's something called the ABC. The alcohol, what's that stand for? Alcohol, New Jersey's Alcohol Beverage Control Agency. Because, of course. And they've decided, there's not even 200 of these little craft brewers in the entire Garden State. There's not even, like, it's 130 people who have a little, for want of a better term, pop-up or microbrewery. Tiny little operation. They're selling their beer. They're trying to have a little fun, maybe bring in a food truck. And wouldn't you know, the New Jersey, what's it called, ABC, they've decided to lower the boom on these poor little guys who are actually having some pretty great success with these stupid regulations. I mean, these ridiculously aggressive regulations. And they've decided, you know what, this doesn't seem all that fair. So they've gone to court and they've partnered with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and they're going to sue the Garden State over these new regulations. We're going to get into this coming up at the bottom of the hour. You should know about it, particularly if you're a craft brew fan out there or you're a fan of microbreweries. I will tell you more about it coming up.
It's Mike Gallagher. Join me this morning at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now let's get you back to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with the great Chris DeGaulle.
Interesting story that caught our eye in South Jersey out of Clarksboro. A company, I was just looking them up online because I didn't know a lot about them. They actually are a brewery and a coffee roastery, which is an interesting combo. It's called Death of the Fox Brewing Company in Clarksboro. And they are embroiled in a tussle right now over New Jersey's Alcohol Beverage Control Agency. They have dispatched a fantastic organization we've talked to many times on the show, the Pacific Legal Foundation. The Vice President of Legal Affairs at PAC Legal joins us now, Jim Burling. And Jim, I'm first of all grateful for your time, and I love every time I talk to you, you're always on the side of good and righteousness, you guys at PAC Legal. So I trust that's the same in this story. Good morning.
Good morning. Absolutely. This is a simple little brewery in Clarksboro, New Jersey, that's trying to operate, and they're running into all kinds of hassles with the New Jersey regulators. New Jersey statute, the legislature passed a law allowing these sort of enterprises to thrive and prosper. And then some bar owners apparently in New Jersey thought the competition was a little tough. And instead of getting better themselves, they decided to convince the New Jersey Bureau of Alcoholic Beverages to clamp down by having ridiculous regulations against advertising, against having food in the premises, things that are not in the statute. But the New Jersey agency decided to do it anyway.
So there are something like 6,000 established bar, restaurant, and liquor stores in the Garden State. There aren't that many of these microbreweries, if that's what you want to call them. In fact, I don't even think there are 200 of them in the entire state. So interesting that people would find them a competitive threat or whatever, but I guess that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, and we're dealing with an agency that is pretty much in the pocket of the established liquor service industry, the bars, the restaurants, and that kind of thing. And when they started complaining, saying, hey, these guys are doing well, maybe they're taking business away from us, which is disputable. In 2019, the department passed these new regulations, as I said, limiting advertising, limiting food services, saying that if you go into a brewery like this, you have to have a tour, which is part of New Jersey law. But the tour has to be done in a certain highly inconvenient way. Just to make life difficult for these people. And apparently the only justification is that, and I quote, they wanted to have a, quote, balance of competition between the states. There's only 130 of these little microbreweries and the 6,000 bars, restaurants, and liquor stores.
So these poor 130 microbreweries, and by the way, this also goes for food trucks, I guess, right?
You can't have a food truck in your little microbrewery. You can't. See, you can't. If you want to have a special event, say some live DJ event or watching sports on the big screen, you can't advertise that, and you can't bring in food trucks, but you can maybe give away little packages of granola bars. And I'll tell you, when I have a beer, there's nothing I want more than to watch a granola bar down with that.
So they came up with Jim Burling at the Pacific Legal Foundation, talking about specifically, we're talking about the owner, Chuck Garrity, who owns Death of the Fox Brewing Company. He's personally partnered with you guys, but I suppose that something like this inadvertently represents everybody in the same kind of business, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We don't think that there should be these kind of restrictions solely to basically tip the scales in favor of established establishments versus the newcomer microbreweries. And so all 130 of them could benefit from this. And we're also hoping that the precedent we will set could limit the ability of New Jersey regulatory agencies to adopt these so-called special rulings without going through the New Jersey process when you pass regulations. So New Jersey is calling these things guidelines. And that brings me to, if you recall, Captain Barbossa in Pirates of the Caribbean said, well, these pirate codes are more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules. Well, the fact is, there are actual rules, and to have an actual rule in New Jersey, you have to go through a process. You have to have notice and comments so the public can look at it and comment on it, and so people can see it without this thing just suddenly coming down on high because the department wants to do it on the sly.
New Jersey's Alcoholic Beverage Control Agency, you were mentioning this. It's hilarious. I read this. Food trucks no longer allowed, for instance. Breweries could host no more than 25 special events a year is their new standard. And special events, what does that mean? Anything advertised beyond the brewery. Trivia and fundraisers, for example. Live or DJ spun music. It also counts as an event, advertised or not. So are sports televised for view. So you take something like the NCAA men's basketball tournament. You could blow through your 25 allotted events for the year, in theory, in a week or two.
In a week, or if you wanted to advertise that you're having the World Cup on, you're gone. You're done for it. And trivia contests? No, I cannot for the life of me figure this out. Look, I grew up in Jersey. I moved away years ago, but I grew up in Jersey, and I never recall that there's a public harm from having a trivia contest.
So when this all comes right down to it, you think this is some kind of lobbying effort by bigger business to hassle these guys that are having pop-up success with their microbreweries? Is that the way you read this?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the justification that the New Jersey ABC gave for this, that they wanted to balance the interests between the 6,000 establishments and the 130 microbreweries. And what does balancing mean? It means limiting competition. Well, how do you limit competition? You limit advertising. You limit the ability of people to have, good food with food trucks, et cetera. It's all about competition.
It's insane. And again, you guys do this at PAC Legal at no charge, defending guys like Chuck Garrity. I'm so grateful that you're out there and you represent the little guy in fights against big government like New Jersey's Alcoholic Beverage Control Agency. Clarksboro, New Jersey, is where you can find Death of the Fox Brewing Company. It looks like an interesting place. I've not been. Have you?
I have not been there either. It does look interesting. It was named after the first inn in New Jersey that served the first fox hunters in New Jersey. So it has a long storied historical connection to New Jersey history dating back to, I think, 1610 when the Death of the Fox Inn was first established. It's no longer a public inn, but the brewery is taking over for that. So, I mean, I think it's fascinating. And if I could mention that, if people want to learn more about it, go on our website, pacificlegal.org, and you can read more about Death of the Fox and the brewery and the public threat from NCAA men's basketball tournament.
How does this play out in terms of timing? Is this something you wait on for a while? Will you be granted a hearing? How does it play out? When do you think you could have a verdict one way or the other?
Well, we filed our complaint in September of this year. We're expecting a hearing rather soon in New Jersey. I don't have a specific date that's been set yet. And we hope to have this resolved hopefully within a year at the trial court, unless one side or the other has to appeal it. Then it could take a year or more. But it's worth the wait if you want to have a trivia contest in a microbrewery.
And what are you ultimately seeking? That we would just do away with these silly rules?
Yeah, what we want to have these rules tossed out because we think they violate the New Jersey Administrative Procedures Act. We think that they violate the First Amendment. And if New Jersey wants to have rules like this, then it can do it through the lawful way of having notice and comment and abiding by the First Amendment. And the First Amendment, because these limits on advertising of these 25 events, simply doesn't advance any legitimate governmental interest.
Yeah, and a governor probably could act unilaterally and do away with this if he wanted to, I would guess.
The governor could.
Yeah. Probably won't hold our breath for that, though, Jim Burling at Pacific Legal Foundation. Clarksboro is where you find, again, Death of the Fox Brewing Company. Drop by, say hello, maybe tip one back and celebrate those guys and their good fight. Chuck Garrity, the owner there. Jim, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Hey, you're very welcome.
Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. I didn't get to this yesterday, and I wanted to. It's funny, I was reading in another publication, the editorial board at what I call the Falling Star, the Kansas City Star. I come, you know, from Kansas City. And so I still regularly sift through the old paper. And I call it the paper because it literally is a single sheet of paper these days. If you actually saw this, it's a lot like the Inquirer. These once distinguished newspapers that used to be thick and full of information, now they're like leaflets. It's like a depressing physical thing to hold. But, I still monitor this stuff. It comes across my email. And one of the things that they wrote at their editorial board the other day was, hey, you are getting way too complacent out there. Flu, RSV, tridemic is kicking up out there, and you're still out there not wearing a mask. I'm not making this up. The Kansas City Star was advocating that people start putting masks back on as they get together with families and friends for events, admonishing people for not huddling up in their homes and not putting masks back on, cheering the idea that we need to return to this again. And as I read that yesterday, and, you know, we talked about the tridemic, which I've been laughing at mocking. Dr. McCary was here yesterday talking about that. It brought to mind a piece that I've just had tucked away, and I meant to get to it. Do you know, of all places, this ran in the Washington Post about a week ago. Headline, Americans are choosing to be alone, and here's why we should reverse that. I mean, good for the Washington Post for allowing it to run, and I mean allowing it, because the Washington Post and most mainstream media, like I said, the Inquirer, the Falling Star, you know, these places have all cheerled you being a hypochondriac and being terrified of being out of doors and being alone and locked away in your home. They love what Communist China is doing. They love zero COVID policy. They think that's achievable. They do. Honestly, they do. And they think if everyone would just behave and do what they want, COVID would go away. No one would ever die again. No one would ever get sick. When in fact, as Dr. McCary said, and we all know what's true, when you do nothing but lock yourself away and isolate yourself, what happens then when you finally do go out and expose yourself to anybody? You get much more sick, actually. Yeah, everyone needs to understand this. The less you're exposed to other people, the more vulnerable you become. Let me say that again, just for you in the back who may not have heard me. The less exposed you are to people, the more vulnerable you are to illness when you encounter it. You know, my mother was a school teacher for 30 years, public school teacher, 30 years. She almost never got sick. Now, I can't prove this. This isn't scientific. It's anecdotal. But you can bet a bunch of crumb crunchers day in, day out for 30 years. That makes your immune system pretty hardy. Not that she never got sick. Of course she did. But I'm just saying it was a rare event that my mother was ever home sick because she was constantly exposed to viruses and colds and flu bugs. You get natural immunity built up to things that occur as it passes around and floats around in populations. But if you hide and you mask up and you never expose yourself to anybody because you don't want to get sick, you're just waiting to get violently ill the next virus you come into contact with. Not to mention the mental toll. This has broken us, this COVID period of time, this almost 3-year episode now, has broken a lot of people. Americans are choosing to be alone, and here's why we should reverse that. A guy called Bryce Ward wrote it. Brilliant, brilliant piece. He's an economist, apparently, but I think this is as much philosophical as it is scientific. The COVID-19 pandemic wreaked havoc on our social lives. Cancellations, closures, fear of potential deadly infection led us to hunker down and avoid acquaintances, coworkers, extended family. Time spent with friends went down. Time spent alone went up. Thanksgiving was not spared. Americans spent 38% less time with friends and extended family over the Thanksgiving weekend in the past 2 years than they had a decade prior. And now the scarier news. Our social lives were withering dramatically before COVID-19. Between 2014 and 2019, time spent with friends went down. Time spent alone went up by more than it did during the pandemic. According to the Census Bureau's American Time Use Survey, the amount of time the average American spent with friends was stable, about 6.5 hours per week between 2010 and 2013. And then in 2014, time spent with friends began to decline. What happened in 2014? Well, he notes this. You want to guess? What do you think might have caused this? This is before COVID. What might have caused a marked decline in people spending time with others versus spending time alone? Right around 2014, this isn't when it came to be, but it became more prolific in the day-to-day lives of most Americans. What am I talking about?
Facebook?
Cell phones.
Oh, smart.
The smart device.
Yep.
The computer in your hand. By 2014, half of us had possession of the device in our hand. And that's when people spending time together stopped. People spending time alone increased dramatically. And then COVID came. And just imagine, during the pandemic, time with friends fell further. In 2021, the average American spent only 2 hours and 45 minutes a week with friends. That is a near 60% decline. Similar declines can be seen even when the definition of friends is expanded to include neighbors, coworkers, clients. The average American spent 15 hours per week with this broader group of friends a decade ago, 12 hours a week in 2019, 10 hours a week in last year, 2021. On average, Americans did not transfer that lost time to spouses, partners, or children. Instead, they chose to be alone. No single group drives this trend. Men and women, white and non-white, rich, poor, urban, rural, married, unmarried, parents, non-parents, all saw proportionately similar declines in time spent with others. The pattern holds for both remote and in-person workers. The percentage decline is also similar in young and old. However, given the amount of time young people spend with friends, the absolute decline among Americans age 15 to 19 is staggering. Relative to 2010 through 2013, the average American teen spent approximately 11 fewer hours with friends each week in 2021, a 64% decline. Teenagers alone. What's also increasing dramatically amongst teenagers? Suicide. It's too soon to know the long-term consequences of this shift, he writes, but it seems safe to assume the decline of our social lives is a worrisome development. Spending less time with friends is not a best practice by most standards, and it might contribute to other troubling social trends, isolation, worsening mental health, particularly among young people, rising aggressive behavior, and violent crime. Americans rate activities are more meaningful and joyful when friends are present. Friends and social connections build on themselves and produce memories and fellowship. They also boost health and lead to better economic outcomes. Why do you think church families are so important? Why do you think the health of a church is so important? Why do you think it's biblical that we gather together to worship? Why do you think? It's as old as the Bible. The Word of God says we should be together. But again, we all know that in 2022, what's the Word of God mean? You don't even have to be, you don't have to, if you were born a boy and you don't feel like it anymore, God screwed up and you can alter that genetically with the help of the children's hospital down the street. So that's where we are. So why should what God has to say about us gathering together and not being alone, why should that matter? But at any rate, we can hope as COVID-related barriers recede, people will change course, Mr. Ward writes at the Washington Post. Time with friends did increase last year after the shot rolled out. However, at the end of last year, it was still an hour below the 2019 level. Pew Research survey made public in August suggests COVID might have changed us permanently. No kidding. I've only been shouting about that for 2.5 years. 35% of Americans say participating in large gatherings, going out and socializing in person has become less important since the pandemic. Potential harms of these trends are sufficient to demand Americans devote some resources to understanding and reversing this. You can help reverse these trends today without waiting for the researchers and policymakers to figure it all out. It's the holidays. Don't skip events with your family. Go to that holiday party. Throw one yourself. Go hang out with friends for coffee or hike or in a museum or a concert, whatever. You'll feel better. You'll create memories. You'll boost your health, stumble across valuable information, and so will your companions. Put effort into building relationships you can count on in good times and bad, because as the song goes, that's what friends are for. Besides, you might just have a good time. He's right. I mean, I'm not going to deny I'm not great at it, but every time I do, I always feel better. Every time I go force myself to actually get together with people that I like, I always end up, I'm glad that I did it. I never come away from a dinner with friends or going out with people that have invited me out, even if I think, oh, I got to get dressed and I don't, I always feel better. I always feel better when I leave worship with other people on Sundays. I always feel better after I leave a Bible study. I always feel better after I've been with people. And as my wife will attest, and I don't want to be a hypocrite here, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, when I spend, and I do spend, an inordinate amount of time by myself, and it only got worse during COVID, and it has not been good for me mentally. And I recognize that, and so does she, and we talk about it, and I pray about it a lot. But what scares me is that young people now find that acceptable. You know, it's one thing to be an old guy on the porch by himself shaking his fist. That's one thing. But to be a teenager and to be isolated and alone, that's dangerous. It shouldn't be. None of us are built that way. I mean, we joke, I want to be alone. I don't like crowds. And yeah, I mean, that's fine to a degree. There's that, and then there's kind of an unhealthy reclusiveness that's, you know, aided by the devices in our hands, and it's just that's darkness. That's a gateway to something really dark. So I wanted to share that because I think it's important, profoundly important. I tweeted it out. Guy called Bryce Ward, he wrote this on the 23rd in the Washington Post. Americans are choosing to be alone, and here's why we should reverse that. And I would humbly submit to men in particular in this audience, we really are bad about this. We men are much worse about it than women, on balance. Men are kind of loners, and they would never really admit they like company or need it or even want to talk to one another about anything. And that's something I hope men reverse course in this country as well, because we really do need one another. We need the moral support. We need the backing. We need the companionship. We need the positive influence of good friends, particularly people of faith. We need one another. Iron sharpens iron and all of that.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
The Pennsylvania Senate yesterday voted to formally accept articles of impeachment filed by the House against Larry Krasner, setting the stage for a trial next month. I say next month because today is the first day of December. Did you know that? That completely snuck up and bit me this morning as I was getting ready. I was like, wow, it's December 1st.
Yeah, man. Wow.
So, yeah, January is next month, we now officially say.
Whoosh. Yikes.
So, yeah, January hits and the trial of Larry Krasner's impeachment will get underway. Proceedings mark the first time in nearly 30 years the upper chamber has moved forward on impeachment. That's likely to happen. I think this has Democrat support now. So that will be historic to actually see a district attorney in Philadelphia impeached by the legislature in Harrisburg. University of Pennsylvania students criticizing the school for initiating a disciplinary process in more than 30 cases involving students engaged in protests, including taking over the football field during halftime at the homecoming game last month. Emma Glasser, senior material science, engineering, and environmental science major from Princeton, says, "It's just alarming to us that they have been responding with such fervor in a disciplinary, punitive way rather than engaging with us in a constructive, regenerative way." Shut up. I have no time for that. You're a punk college kid. I don't care that you're from Princeton or Penn. I don't care. You're a punk college kid, and administrators do not have to sit down and engage in a constructive way with you when you stop a football game from happening. To hell with you. You're disruptive. And you should be punished accordingly. I am so this is why I would never I would suck as an administrator. I am tired of your heavy-handed tactics. I want you to speak to me in a constructive way where we sit down. No, beg your pardon. You have no legitimacy. You have no standing. I run a university. You're a twerpy punk little kid. You don't interrupt my football games on my campus. You're suspended. Get out. That's not constructive. Okay, how about this? You're expelled. There's your constructive. I tell you, we've raised a generation of kids that think they're entitled just because they throw tantrums to have sit-down conversations and constructive. No, no. At my house, I run a benevolent dictatorship. I don't have constructive conversations. You break the rules, I punish you accordingly. That's that. Holiday market vendors in Philadelphia's City Hall asking for more security. Merry Christmas.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for doing what you're doing in the media.
Good morning, Chris. I listen to you every morning. Thanks.
Mr. Segal, may he whose father gave us life keep you well and safe.
10 years ago, how many knew what the hell a supply chain was? No, I'm serious.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
All right, sit up straight in there, Fast Eddie. Best face forward. We got a big get on the phone. I want us to look impressive. He's my colleague, the master of the afternoon drive home here on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, Dr. Sebastian Gorka. You hear him every weekday, coast to coast across the country on great radio stations like this one. And he joined. I'm honored that he was able to make time this morning. I first of all, I hope I didn't wake you up. Seb, good morning.
Ben Hutt. At ease, gentlemen. At ease.
How are you, Seb?
I'm good. It's a little chilly here in the swamp, but it's a beautiful sunny morning.
Hey, I got to ask you something, just between you and me. Your lovely wife, Katie, I love her. I love your wife tremendously. Does she object to whoever that woman is you're laying next to in your new commercial on Fox?
She thought it was hilarious when I said, hey, watch this new ad. It's really funny. Look at my PJs, because if you haven't seen it, they made me get in bed in my suit, which is, of course, how I sleep, because I don't sleep. And then she said, I didn't even see there was somebody in the bed. And some cretin on Twitter this morning DM'd me and said, who wrote that script? Because you get in the bed in your suit and you've got an inflatable doll next to you. No, that's a very nice actress called Stephanie, okay? And the whole point is, it's a joke because I go to bed in my suit. Some people, you know, as my good friend Chris Plant says here in D.C., every day is an IQ test, Chris.
I love the spot. I think it's very, very funny. They make, you know what I love about you is, I was trying to explain somebody to you the other day. I was explaining that you have this, there is an aura about you. It's sincere and real. You're a classy guy. And the whole spot was done kind of like, it's kind of like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like if a guy from a prep school went to bed in his suit. It's like, I believe it. I believe that you would go to bed in cufflinks. I believe that about you.
Get this. I have to fly from D.C. to Seattle for Relief Factor to film those two commercials, the one with the dog outside and the one with the sleep thing. So I flew to bloody Seattle for 120 seconds minute of footage. And I arrive and they say, hey, we think this is going to be really funny. I've been in a plane for 5 hours. We think this is going to be really funny. You're going to get into bed with your suit on. And I'm going, what the hell have I? What? And it's like, I can't say no because they were.
No, I love it because the whole set, if people haven't seen it yet, the whole set, like there's a roaring fire. It's like a proper English study. There's a stuffed pheasant on the table. There's an ashtray. You're having some tea.
Hang on, you mean you don't have stuffed pheasants in your studio right now?
But the whole vibe is totally, that's not really who you are, but it's like there's something about you where you go, I bet his den looks like that. I could see that. Anyway, good to have you, my friend. Thank you for waking up early with us.
Sure.
So I overheard a conversation that you and our buddy Eric Bolling were having not too long ago, uh-huh. And it piqued my interest. And because I haven't said much about this week, and some listeners of mine have asked me, Stigall, why aren't you talking about this? I said, because I don't really have an opinion. I really don't. And then I heard you and Eric talking about it, so I thought, I'm just going to call him and have him explain it to me. This is I'm talking about the dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Kanye.
Right. Right.
You kind of seem to suggest, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, and Eric sort of seemed to agree, that your concern with it is that there aren't people around Trump helping him sift through all the people that want at him. Because lots of people want at him, want his blessing, want him to hold up the book and help it sell. That's constantly happening to him. And he's a charitable guy who's not really closed off to anybody, naturally, I don't think, right? You know him.
I did a whole monologue on the Mar-a-Lago incident 2 days ago on my show. Here's the bottom line. For those who don't know the president, for mean tweets and all, and you know how he dealt with dictators like Little Kim, he is one of the most gracious and hospitable people you will ever meet. I mean, I can tell you stories how my wife worked in the administration as well. She was the press secretary for Customs and Border Patrol, but she only met the president maybe twice at a Christmas party. And I went back to the White House like 3 years after I left to interview the president, and I walk in. First thing he says, first thing out of his mouth is, how's your lovely Katie? And it's like, wow. What? You remember her name? And you've only met her twice? I mean, this is who he is. And I know what happened at Mar-a-Lago. This is a club, okay? This isn't a private residence. This isn't the White House. This is a club with a dining room. He sees Kanye. Kanye comes up to him. Kanye, who, by the way, may be having some serious psychiatric issues right now, beyond what he's said that's anti-Semitic. He needs some mental help. But the president remembers what he did when he was in the Oval, that he came there on camera with a red MAGA hat on. And he's just being gracious, saying, sure, Kanye, sit down and have dinner with me. And then these two scumbag, filth of the earth strap hangers who are now, suckling at the billionaire teat that is, Kanye West's whatever's left of his money, Milo Yiannopoulos, who wants to normalize pedophilia. Seriously, look it up. And the other guy, Nick Fuentes, he's a bad dude. And Nick Fuentes, who I've had run-ins with, who actually says the Holocaust didn't happen and thinks that's funny. And President Trump doesn't know them from a hole in the ground. And then we find out afterwards from that CNBC article 2 days ago, Milo admits this was a setup to undermine President Trump. So that's the reality. This was a setup. He was being gracious. Kanye needs help, and Nick Fuentes, Milo Yiannopoulos, bad dudes. However, and here's the bigger point, and this goes back to my time in the White House, and this is what Eric and I were talking about. I don't care what your issue is, okay? I don't care what. I'm a big Second Amendment guy. Whether your issue is pro-life, First Amendment, the economy, the border, it matters not one whit unless you have the right personnel in place. And my biggest concern, because I know he'll be the nominee, and I know he can win if we have fair and free elections, is getting personnel right, because Reagan was on the money. But personnel is policy. And right now, I don't see that gatekeeper. I see a lot of nice, willing young kids around him. I see some questionable people who are a little bit older, but I don't see a James Baker. I don't see a Newt Gingrich stature kind of person who's running the enterprise. And, you know, if things go south in Arizona, I have a few recommendations, and the short list starts with somebody called Carrie Lake. But he needs a serious, hardcore person around him who's not just the gatekeeper, but the chief of staff and the eminent grise and the chief advisor.
Do you see yourself as someone who would be interested in assisting with another campaign? So, I mean, obviously, you've got the show and TV and all the things that you do. I mean, do you see yourself as being interested and active in another Trump term somehow, or no?
Look, people keep asking me this, you know, would you serve if the president asked you again? And my answer, and I mean this, it's not being flip, is it's not just an honor to serve a president, but it is a duty to say yes if you are requested. I mean, that is like, you know, one of the highest honors ever, and it's also a duty. On top of that, you know, they need to get the personnel thing right. So I've got some ideas. I've got some things I've written down that I'm going to present to the president on how I wouldn't mind advising him on how to have the right filter, because we were surrounded by seditionists, saboteurs, from, you know, General Kelly to Colonel Vindman. We need solid people who love America to be working for the president if he wins the second term. So I do that. I don't know whether I'd be in the White House or doing it formally. And the only other job I would take is if he wants to have a little bit of fun, if he wants to nominate me to be ambassador to the United Nations, I'd do that, because I think as soon as I stepped in there, the building would catch fire. So that would be fun.
Dr. Sebastian Gorka with us, host of his own fantastic show each and every day, 3 to 6 Eastern, all across the country. Seb, when the president says...
Forget about my fantastic show. I just want to repeat for all the people listening to your show. When you took the stage at the Fuge for our town hall series, our Battleground tour, it was like, you know, the Beatles stepped on stage. You are so loved in Philly. You know, I don't get that anywhere. So I don't know whether you give out bags of crack in the mail or something to your listeners, but they love you, dude.
Heroin. They all had heroin injections prior to the show. Every one of them. No. Isn't this a wonderful town? This city, this audience that listens to this radio station, they were electric that night. That was the first time we'd all been out together in years. What a night that was.
But it's a great town and great city, but I stayed the night, and downtown, oh my gosh, killed downtown. If it's not the smoke of, you know, dope and the trash and the empty restaurants, somebody fix Philly, please.
Seb, I wanted to ask you about you were nice enough to have me on your show to kind of talk about what happened in Pennsylvania in the election, and I said it's the mail-in vote, and I know you share that point of view. We've got to get better at the ballot collection game days, weeks, months ahead of election day. President Trump continues to seem to signal he doesn't think as long as there's a mail-in vote that it's going to be fair. And I know there are a lot of people in this audience who feel that same way, but I don't think there's anything we can do about it, Seb. I hate to say it that way, but I don't. So what's the approach?
It's very simple. This is a bitter pill. I swallowed it a few weeks ago. I talked about this on my show. So as conservatives, we have to get beyond our default setting. We believe in chain of custody, and that's very commonsensical. We think the best way to vote is on voting day. We want to go personally to the polling station, show our ID, get a ballot, hold it in our hand, fill it out, put it in the ballot box or put it in the scanner. And that makes sense. But I'm sorry, we can't allow that to be our driving principle when you look at Fetterman and you look at, you know, Hochul and everything else. The last election was not won on merits. The idea that half of Pennsylvania voted before the debate with Oz tells you one thing very clearly. We don't have elections where people go into the polling station and decide on the merits. Oh, I'm going to choose John Smith. No, I'm going to choose, you know, Jay Green. No, we have machines of ballot collection. It's not votes, it's ballots. And where we can't change it in states like Virginia, I live in Virginia, which has a Republican governor, Chris, we have 45 stinking days of voting. 45. Yeah. That's not an election. That's insanity.
And so, you know what I heard about that? If I may, just to make your point, our friend Larry O'Connor said to me, Chris, you know what Glenn Youngkin did when he was campaigning for governor in Virginia? He came on the radio show in Washington, D.C., and he said, hey, I don't like it, but you should know today is day one to start casting ballots. And right. I'd ask that you get out and start casting them. And apparently Glenn Youngkin ran that way in Virginia. Is that right?
Yeah, and I've heard so, and they're friends of mine, and I know why they did it. I had so many of my buddies, conservative show hosts, say, and you know, and get your friends to the polling station on voting day. And I'm thinking, but it's too late by then. I mean, it's just too late. So where we can't change it, we have to out-organize them. It's a question of organization. It's going to be about message as well, because I don't want to make it all mechanical. Because tell me, Chris, did you know what the GOP message on life and abortion was in the midterms? Because I sure as hell don't.
No,
you don't know what your party's message is after a historic Supreme Court decision, there is a problem. And when you've got Mitch McConnell pulling $10 million out of MAGA races in New Hampshire, in Arizona, and giving them to rhinos like Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, there's a lot of blame to go around. But first things first, we have to have a ground game.
Seb, I wonder what you think about what appears to be, although Matt Gaetz is arguing this is not the case and don't count your chickens, a Kevin McCarthy Speaker of the House. Gaetz keeps saying don't bank on it. How do you read that? What's going to happen there? And are you happy with McCarthy if, in fact, he is the next speaker?
I'll be brutally honest with you about Kevin, and he's been on the show not for a while. I think Mark Levin said it after the election. He nailed it perfectly. He said, Mitch McConnell is evil, and at least you can say that Kevin McCarthy is an anti-MAGA. Now, if that's the best we got, is an anti-MAGA, in an age where President Trump got more votes than any incumbent president in U.S. history. The bottom line is, Kevin is a good guy. But he's weak, and he does that which comports with the most pressure that has been exerted on him in the last 24 hours. And that's not a Speaker of the House. You know, if he listens to America First guys, he does America First stuff. If somebody else whispers in his ear, the idea that he said we may impeach Mayorkas. Mayorkas needs to go to prison. He doesn't need to be impeached. We've had 110,000 fentanyl deaths because of the open border. We've had illegal stream into this country who are given phones paid for by you and me and plane tickets to wherever they want to go. That man is aiding and abetting the cartels. So when Kevin McCarthy said stuff like that last week, I go, you know, that's not the new America First GOP we're looking for. So, you know, I love Matt Gaetz. This is going to be very interesting. And there's another issue. We're going to have like an 8-seat majority or maybe a 7-seat majority. That's going to be very – you need a spine. When your majority is that thin, the danger of being milquetoast and center of the road is very high. So you need somebody even more convinced that we need to save America.
Listening to you, this is just my read. You feel like – I don't want to put words in your mouth. Where do you stand right now on Ron DeSantis? You seem like maybe you're a little agitated at DeSantis. Am I reading you wrong?
Look, Ron has been a great governor in Florida, and he's done some amazing things there. But he has been potentially allowing himself to be utilized as a weapon of billionaires who don't like President Trump and rhinos who want to have business as usual. So here's a couple of things. Number one, anybody who says, it's got to be Ron, it's got to be Ron and not Trump because he's so different. And I think, hang on a second, why is Ron successful in Florida? It's like the Austin Powers movies. He is President Trump's mini-me. He governs Florida in an absolute reflection on a smaller scale of what President Trump did for the country. So you're telling me the guy who's copying President Trump is better than President Trump? So number one, the argument doesn't hold water. And then secondly, here's my line that kind of leaves me a little bit queasy. Imagine somebody is talking about you, Chris, or me, for about a year saying, you know, I don't like Sean Hannity anymore, or I don't like Mark Levin, and, you know, his style just irks me. I think he should be replaced by Chris DeGaulle. Or, no, Seth Gorka needs to replace Sean Hannity. Now, if that is going on for a year in public and you don't say anything, I would say, Chris, you've got to make a statement, Chris. People are saying you should take down one of the biggest names in conservative media. And the fact that DeSantis says nothing makes me think, huh, what kind of guy is this? Is this a politician? I don't like that, Chris. I want things to be in your face and honest.
So you'd prefer him just say, you know what, look, I do intend to make a run or not. You just say it. You would be less irritated with him if he just said, I'm going
to
run.
I'd like him to address it. And I'd also like him to recognize publicly that he would still be a no-name congressman that nobody had ever heard of if President Trump hadn't campaigned for him. Remember, he was way behind. He was not going to be the governor of Florida until President Trump endorsed and campaigned for him. And now it's a little bit like et tu, Brute. I mean, you are governor because of President Trump, and now you're allowing everybody who's a rhino to sing your praises. That leaves a weird taste in my mouth. How about you?
Well, look, you know this is true because I know you hear from these folks, and I have a lot of folks like this in the audience, and I've acknowledged them, and I'm acknowledging this, and I'm going to do this exactly like I've done the primaries past. I'm gonna watch from the sidelines and let this audience, who I trust, make the decision. I'm not taking a side, but I hear this.
What a crazy idea. How about we do a primary? How about everybody wants to run?
Yeah, right. But here's what I hear. Trump, I love what he did. He was great for his time, but it's too toxic. They'll never let him win. He can't win. The Kanye thing, the distractions. We need a fresh face. We need to turn the page, say a number of people in this audience.
Two,
and you would say what?
Two things. What did they say about Trump in 2015?
Yeah.
Chris?
You mean the critics of Trump at that time?
No. Everybody. Oh. Everybody. He can't win. Yeah. He can't win.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yes.
when the Billy Bush tape thing erupted, 16 points down.
I readily admit back then I was that guy, and that's why I am so careful today. I won't ever make that mistake again. I did that then.
And here's the more important one, and I tweeted this last night. Who do you trust to really drain the swamp? Who do you trust? Do you think a person who needs to get reelected to a second term is going to bring a flamethrower to D.C.? Okay, I'm not just talking about Ron. I'm talking about anybody, okay? Anybody who wants to be president for two terms, I'm sorry, they will not clean the swamp. President Trump is the only person who, because he can't get reelected to a third term, he doesn't have to play nice. And he can come in here and he can get rid of all the corruption. Like he promised first time. It was hard because he had people inside the wire who were sabotaging him every single day. If he has people controlling his personnel, and I volunteer if he wants it, or somebody else, you know, Mark Levin or Joe DiGenova, real hardcore people, if he has a good team, he can drain the swamp. And only a man who has nothing to lose, who doesn't need to be reelected, will do what has to be done. If Ron is the nominee, is he going to do what has to be done and risk his second term? I think we all know the answer to that question, Chris.
The man's name is Dr. Sebastian Gorka. You hear his show, America First, every day, coast to coast, from 3 to 6 on great radio stations like this one, Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer. Seb, I appreciate all your time this morning. Thank you for visiting with us, my friend.
That was super fun. Thank you, buddy. God bless you and the listeners.
They were salivating over at MSNBC this week. I torture myself by monitoring them because, you know, I like to keep a sharp eye on the opposition out there. They were so happy about this Oath Keepers founder, Stuart Rhodes, convicted Tuesday of seditious conspiracy. They were applauding the Justice Department. Julie Kelly, our great friend and senior writer at American Greatness, has followed the events of January 6th, the political prisoners to this day of January 6th, those who have been prosecuted, persecuted, some still held without formal charges. Nobody has covered this like Julie has. And, you know, Julie, first of all, welcome back. I tweeted this morning something that the White House press secretary, Pepe Le Pew, said, and it really it sort of typifies this attitude, the government's attitude. And I think sometimes it just seeps into our consciousness and we think that this is normal. And I want to remind everyone that this is not normal. When we have open conversations that they're monitoring us, they're watching Twitter, they're watching the media, they're monitoring for hate speech and misinformation. This is all upside down. We monitor government. We watch them. Government doesn't get to monitor us and determine what they'll allow. And we're just increasingly, whether it's speech or anything else, we're increasingly gravitating toward this media cheer-led notion that government monitors us and decides what kind of behavior and speech they'll allow. So with all that, good morning.
Good morning. And I want to give Eddie a thank you for the walk-up, the Ozzy Osbourne walk-up music this morning. It's one of my favorite workout songs, Shot in the Dark.
He's so good at the perfect music.
He is good. Yeah. Well, you know, Chris, I think this is just one of those revelatory moments, too, when we're seeing the what Elon Musk is dealing with. Not just from his competition or media types who are upset they have to pay $8 a month for their blue check, but you openly have the White House threatening that they are keeping an eye on Elon Musk. You hear this from Democratic senators, lawmakers as well. You know, since when is this okay? And it's not a matter of he's doing anything criminal or he's being reckless. He is simply removing you know, the censorship and free speech suppression that we know social media platforms, especially Twitter and Facebook, have engaged in over the last several years. But we also know, too, Chris, thanks to this lawsuit brought by Eric Schmidt and Jeff Landry, the AGs of Missouri and Louisiana, this civil lawsuit that is really forcing the government and these social media companies to reveal their deep collusion, collaboration between the two entities related to COVID vaccines and, of course, Hunter Biden's laptop. So we're getting a lot of information. You know what? It should alarm all Americans, even Democrats and those on the left, who once were the guardians, the biggest guardians of free speech and political activity, now, you know, moving in this really dangerous direction.
And when you hear people like Elizabeth Warren, I mean, you know, gaslighting was the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition or the word of the year, and for good reason, because it's never been more well applied and used than by Democrats. I mean, this, you want to hear what gaslighting is by definition? Listen to Elizabeth Warren yesterday.
Republicans say that Democrats are picking on Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is doing just fine.
But do you think that users have a right to freedom of speech, even if what they're saying is wrong or offensive?
I think that one human being should not decide how millions of people communicate with each other. One human being should not be able to go into a dark room by himself and decide, oh, that person gets heard from, that person doesn't. That's not how it should work.
That's not how it should work, and yet that's literally how it's been working, Julie. That's gaslighting on full display.
it has been working that way. And Elizabeth Warren, of course, her lips are moving, so she's lying. Elon Musk is not silencing or telling anyone how they can't communicate. He is replatforming, onboarding people who lost their accounts, especially after January 6th, including President Trump, for no reason. Deplatforming people who were telling the truth about quote-unquote vaccines and social distancing and all of the COVID mitigation strategies, in addition to the harm, irreversible harm, they've caused our children and adults, for that matter. So they don't like that Elon Musk is really opening this up for the free speech town square that we were initially told it was, that it's seeking to be, to avoid certain regulations, i.e. Section 230. And so this is why they're going after him. And it's, you know, but look, back to the January 6th issue. This was most of the case against the Oath Keepers, Chris, was communications, texts on encrypted channels, even direct messages on Facebook that were retrieved after they were deleted, even some draft messages, if you can believe it, that composed almost all of the evidence against these five men who had their verdicts come in this week.
Yeah, and we know that, I mean, Zuckerberg, in sort of a jaw-dropping moment a few months ago, goes on the Joe Rogan show and basically just outright confesses in the open, for what motivation, I don't know. I don't think he was injected with a truth serum, but he just basically tells Joe Rogan and all of his millions of listeners, oh, yeah, when the FBI came to us and said we wanted, they wanted us to, you know, not share and silence and greatly limit anybody that could see the Hunter Biden story, we did it because they said it was a Russian threat, Russian misinformation. I was really shocked at his candor there. So my point in bringing that up is it's well established and they're not even really afraid to admit it. Yes, we at Big Tech absolutely help the DOJ and the FBI. When they ask us, we will do what they want. They admit it.
Well, and this is when I get back to this lawsuit that, you know, I'm covering pretty extensively on Twitter, this Missouri versus Biden. They are now, the judge has ordered a deposition. We know who the two FBI officials are who routinely met with social media companies. And that is a man named Elvis Chan, who is an FBI agent. Yes, that's his name, Elvis Chan, an FBI agent, cyber expert, allegedly, who works out of the San Francisco field office. Now, this is important, Chris, because this is the FBI field office smack in the middle of Silicon Valley, 300 plus big tech companies and their associate affiliate companies in San Francisco. When was the last time the FBI investigated any big tech company that you can recall, or certainly looked at Facebook for interfering in the 2020 election? How about Facebook's role in January 6th? You'll recall Amazon Web Services cut off Parler, claiming that they were the ones that, you know, fueled the so-called insurrection, when almost all of these cases go back to posts on Facebook. Why wasn't Facebook investigated? Because Facebook was taking their marching orders from the FBI, specifically this man, Elvis Chan, who now has to sit for a court-ordered deposition to explain what the FBI is doing, has been doing, also at the behest, of course, of FBI headquarters in Washington, to tell these social media companies, here's what you amplify, here's what you suppress, here are the types of accounts that you should deplatform. Furthermore, Chris, the court has ordered a deposition from Jen Psaki, the former White House press secretary. Her lawyers, including the DOJ, are desperate. They have tried every trick in the book to prevent her from sitting for this court-ordered deposition because she, of course, bragged publicly from the White House press podium about how they were warning big tech and social media platforms what they should allow to be posted about COVID and vaccines especially, and what they shouldn't be allowed to be posted. This court, this judge has ordered her deposition. She has been fighting this tooth and nail, saying she's too busy as an MSNBC contributor to be bothered to sit for a court-ordered deposition. And so that really will be illuminating as well, because, of course, she was part of communicating the White House strategy for more than 18 months about what the Biden regime expected and demanded these companies to do.
Well, I mean, look, Peter Ducey brings this up with Pepe Le Pew, the White House press secretary, yesterday. He said, well, so you're going to be monitoring speech out there? You're going to try to shut down Twitter? You'll note she doesn't refute the notion that the White House would try to shut down Twitter in this answer. But this, I would think this answer from the White House press secretary could be entered in as evidence in this case as a White House that sees themselves, that is their role. What you just described Jen Psaki is doing, it seems like Karine Jean-Pierre thinks she's part of the same system. Take a listen to this.
When you say that you're going to be monitoring some of the speech on there, if you see something that you don't like, would you try to shut Twitter down?
So look, when you talk about monitoring, it is, I hate to break it to you, Peter, just like everybody else, we very much monitor the news. We pay close attention to everything that you all are reporting, and Twitter's in the news a lot. And so that's what we're paying attention to. We're paying attention to what is in the news and what is being reported on the misinformation that's out there. Let's not forget there's groups like NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, and the public health leaders have been very vocal about their concerns as well. So yes, we are reading what you all are writing and looking at what you all are reporting about the misinformation that is out there. But, I would hope that all Americans, including social media companies, civil rights organizations I just laid out, including Fox as well, will agree that we need to call out hate speech and misinformation.
I mean, it's so calmly, so confidently, we monitor you, we're watching you, we pay attention to what you're, it's just so bass-ackwards, isn't it? But we're so comfortable now with this attitude that that's their job, that's their role. We're monitoring you, Julie.
Well, she also is a named defendant in this lawsuit, so I'll be interested to see if the lawyers now pursue her deposition. But we can all agree we don't want these platforms used to stoke violence or to perpetuate, because it's all subjective, yeah. But we don't want these platforms used in a violent way, but that's not what the White House, anyone else is talking about. They are talking about continuing their false narrative, their dangerous narrative about COVID, about vaccines, about lockdowns, about elections. Look what they did in 2020. They flagged Facebook and Twitter and all of these internet companies flagged information as misinformation. If anyone questioned mail-in ballots or absentee ballots or anything about the very unusual and rigged 2020 election, they were all in cahoots. And then they later bragged about it. And now people like Jen Psaki, who bragged about it for months, wants to clam up when she's under oath in a civil lawsuit that's finally getting to the bottom, where, of course, Republicans once again failed, even though they had the opportunity to expose this destructive and unconstitutional collaboration. The basis of this lawsuit is that the government cannot silence the First Amendment rights of Americans. They cannot institute policies that silence our political activity or free speech, and that's exactly what this White House has been doing, and then federal agencies under Donald Trump, we know, also were doing that.
Julie Kelly, I like to kind of back away and sort of try to go 30,000 foot on some things. And, I know hindsight 2020 and rearview mirror looking may not do us any good at this point. I know you've covered January 6th extensively and the people that are still being held today. But what is undeniably true is whatever you think about that day, the events of that day have been so effectively messaged and weaponized against any voices of dissent against Democrats. The genie's sort of out of the bottle. And I kind of wonder if you could hit rewind a day. I mean, if you're Julie Kelly, Master of the Universe, and you could but that event still happened. But the day it was happening, the day and days after it happened, how would you counsel, or what would you say to the Republican Party generally, Republican candidates or Trump or any or all of the above? Was there a better way to have talked about that day or handled that day? Because it is so far down the road now, the January 6th show trials, the impeachments, today it's morphed into you know, the Democrats have the high ground, the moral high ground. They're the virtuous ones watching out for things that may, you know, lay waste to that kind of behavior again. I mean, it's set up this perfect narrative where we're the insurrectionists at all times and they're the noble ones. I wonder if we could have changed that or stopped that, or if there was a better way forward than the way it was handled.
I can't say in the immediate aftermath of that that it would be useful to even reexamine how Republicans handled it, because, of course, you had Republicans like Mitch McConnell who were in on what happened that day, who described it to a reporter that night as exhilarating, because Mitch McConnell and the establishment, never Trump Republicans, got exactly what they wanted from this 4-hour disturbance, which was eliminating this call for a 10-day election audit, vetting for 12 hours in public the claims and the evidence of election fraud in these 6 swing states. Mitch McConnell begged Republicans not to move forward with disputing the electoral votes in those states and vetting those publicly and moving forward with an audit commission. He got exactly what he wanted. You had Kevin McCarthy a few days later also refer to this as an insurrection. So these are people who, for either cowardice or complicity, it would be useless to try to get anything out of them. I guess looking back now, the only thing I would advise Donald Trump is a blanket pardon for himself, his associates, his family members, Republican lawmakers, and anyone involved, especially in nonviolent acts on January 6th. That would be, I guess, my only suggestion. It would have fallen on deaf ears. But look, now, I do think, Chris, the narrative has dramatically shifted, especially the revelations about FBI informants in both of these so-called militia groups. And the base is not going to tolerate House Republicans ignoring what many believe was now mostly an inside job orchestrated by federal agencies, especially the FBI, concealing evidence such as the thousands of hours of surveillance video. We haven't seen one piece of paper from the U.S. Capitol Police, from Muriel Bowser's office, from Nancy Pelosi's office, who we were told were off limits. People are increasingly suspicious that what we saw on TV on January 6th is not the real story about January 6th. And we are going to have Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene on the Oversight Committee push very hard to get these videos, to get these documents, now to get testimony from a lot of these officials involved. And hopefully, as I've told these devastated January 6th defendants for almost 2 years, we will get the truth to the American people eventually, and you will be exonerated for what's happened to you. And I believe that will be true.
And there are many people, Julie Kelly, who believe that day and Donald Trump subsequently and the whole, you know, now him wanting to run again. Like, let's just that day in particular and this branding. The reason I ask you about that question of the Democrats so effectively kind of branding their opposition as potential January 6ers. Is there is a, I don't know how big a segment of the Republican base voter that has now just said, I'm weary. I don't want to be branded that anymore. I want to move on. So can we just talk about a Ron DeSantis who can't be branded January 6th an insurrection? Can we? I'm just tired. I don't even believe that's true, but I'm tired. And, you know, the narrative's been sewn in and there's nothing we can do about it. So let's just move on. You would say to those people what?
I would say, well, you can think that way, but that's not what we're going to be advocating. Because if you can't complain about a government that you know is fully weaponized, not just against Trump, but against the right, how much more evidence do you need? How many times are we expected to sweep this under the rug like they basically did with Russiagate, like they've done with you have a fully corrupt weaponized FBI. You have to look no further than the Whitmer Fed mapping, which is also something that I think Republicans have said that they're going to investigate. That is ground zero for how weaponized this FBI is. And then it's not just a matter of the seventh floor of the FBI headquarters in D.C. This is a pervasive mindset. We have whistleblowers coming forward talking about the fixation on January 6th, talking about how they don't want to engage in these pre-dawn raids against families, one accused of trespassing at the Capitol. They just arrested two more people 2 days ago, Chris. Almost 2 years later, they can't find the pipe bomber, but they can still find a trespasser who walked in the Capitol for 20 minutes. Think about that. This is not going to end. And any Republican voter says, oh, I'm tired of January 7th. No. This is exactly why no one was held accountable for Russiagate. No one has been held accountable for the weaponization of DOJ and FBI and all these agencies. This is why it accelerated into January 6th. This has to stop. Everyone needs to hear what's been happening with these people, with these agencies, what happened behind the scenes months before January 6th that brought the events of those days to fruition.
And does a Trump, and briefly, Julie, does a Trump candidacy help or hurt this case and this discussion, in your view, going forward, a Trump candidacy for president?
That's a great question. I'm not really sure how it helps because Donald Trump portrays himself as the biggest victim here. Now, there's no doubt that he has been targeted unlike any other elected official or president in history. But the real victims here are the voiceless, the powerless, people who have languished in jail for almost 2 years now before trial and really have had no one speak out for them, no one help fund them, no one donating to their legal fees, finding lawyers for them. They have been completely left hung out to dry. Those are the real victims of January 6th.
Julie Kelly is brilliant. She's the senior writer at American Greatness. Nobody, no one in the United States, not in journalism, not as a citizen, not just a casual observer, nobody has covered January 6th and the victims of that day quite like Julie has. Julie, thank you again, as always. We appreciate your time.
Always great to be here, Chris. Thanks for covering my work and helping me speak for these people. I appreciate it.
You know, I have to tell you, I am, and this is sincere from the very, very bottom of my huge beating heart. I cannot thank you enough. I can't thank this audience enough for being so incredibly kind and supportive of the work we do. Not only is the Harumph Society one of the fastest growing newsletters, new newsletters at Substack, and I hope that you will subscribe. Because tomorrow I am going to officially launch the Harumph Society store. And all of you who are subscribers will get a discount code to go shopping. And I'll have some other news on the Harumph Society tomorrow. But also, Spotify has just come out with their year-end reviews on podcasts. And the Chris Stigall Show podcast is in the top 5% of the most followed podcasts in the universe of podcasts, that which is just remarkable to me, being that there are millions of them.
Philadelphia, AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.